Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're talking about his new book, Mapping the Darkness: The Visionary Scientists Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. Ken, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be here.
What brought you to this subject?
Well, so Mapping the Darkness started with an assignment back in 2013 for Discover magazine on the latest breakthroughs in sleep research. And up until that time, I hadn't really thought much about sleep, except for when I pulled an all-nighter to finish a deadline. But, you know, I was really amazed to discover that, this is this central regulator of our mental, emotional, cognitive, physical health. And I got very curious about, how did this science take shape? And, I discovered when I looked into that there really wasn't a book for lay readers on its history. And so I decided to write one.
I think the amazing thing for me when I began reading your book, I've read a lot about dreams and about some other aspects of sleep. I think the thing that really sort of weirded me out was that originally scientists saw sleep as not worth studying and that it was sort of a non-event.
Yeah, that's right. Because, if you look at a sleeper, they're just lying there sort of drooling onto the pillow. part of it was that there was no way of looking into the brain. But people did start studying sleep in the 19th century because it was regarded as essential to, the Industrial Revolution. You had to know how long workers needed to sleep in order to function properly. You had to know, how their shifts should work. Could people sleep at any hour and wake up at any hour? Were there certain limitations to that? So starting in the mid to late 19th century, there was a certain amount of sleep research that went on, especially in the late 19th century when you had an epidemic of insomnia.
You wrote about that in the book. I would love to read a book just about that. Like, what was happening? Is this because of the Industrial Revolution?
Well, yeah, it's partly that, and also the invention of cheap and plentiful artificial lighting, particularly the electric light bulb, which came in the 1880s.
Wow.
Yeah, up until that point, people had tied their rhythms mostly to the rhythms of nature, to sunrise and sunset and when the animals needed to be fed. And, we were designed by evolution to do that. And as soon as you started allowing people to stay up, to sort of set their own hours of using light bulbs, people's biorhythms got all out of whack and you started noticing this epidemic of insomnia. But the thing is that very few researchers really found this interesting enough to study, and also nobody was studying it full time until 100 years ago, 1925. This scientist named Nathaniel Kleitman started the first full time dedicated sleep lab at the University of Chicago.
It's funny. Your book focuses on four main characters: Nathaniel Kleitman, Eugene Ossorinsky, William Dement, and Mary Karskadon.
Karskadon.
But I want to mention for the benefit of the audiences, you digress into many, many other researchers, scientists, and other people and what they thought. It's just a wild story because when you think about it, how are you going to possibly figure out what's going on in a person's head while they're asleep? And that's the central problem they had to solve. Now let's talk about Nathaniel Kleitman. He had a fascinating backstory with his family. I mean, his family lived in anti-Semitic Russia. They ended up having to travel to Beirut and eventually to Manhattan. And he's described as from a young kid as having a lust for learning.
Yeah. He was very, very precocious. He learned, I found in his archives at the University of Chicago a little 27-page autobiography that he had dictated to his wife in the 1970s. in which he sort of takes his life from year to year. And at the age of two, he learned the Russian alphabet. You know, he grew up speaking Yiddish in his household, but he learned the Russian alphabet in one day at the age of two. He could do complex arithmetic problems in his head at the age of four. He was that kind of person. And he knew from a very early age that there was no future for him in Russia because as a Jewish guy, he was under, you know, I mean, the discrimination against Jewish folks in Russia was just very extreme, to the point where when he was eight, he survived the pogrom in his hometown of Kishinev, a pogrom so violent that it made headlines around the world. So he had really been through the fire, and he escaped Russia on a false passport. He was a refugee. He escaped on a false passport in 1914, on the very day that World War One broke out, landed in Beirut for medical school. And then his first year of medical school, all the Russian students became prisoners of war because Lebanon sided with Germany, I guess, against Russia. And so the Russian students were regarded as enemy aliens, and they were about to be shipped off to a camp, to a concentration camp in the Syrian desert, when the United States sent a battleship to rescue them and drop them in Greece. And Kleitman hopped on a steamer, the first one he could catch, which was going to Ellis Island. It was going to New York City, that is, and he wound up on Ellis Island. So an incredible start to this guy's career, and you have to think that this sort of thing really strengthened him. I mean, gave him, you know, he prepared him for very, very, very tough work and struggle. And also, when he got into academia in the United States, he spent about a year in the Lower East Side doing odd jobs, put himself to City College, and then went on to University of Chicago for his PhD. And at that time, you know, anti-Semitism was also rife in the United States. And so if you were a young researcher and you're a Jewish researcher, you had to figure out something that the gatekeepers didn't already dominate, because you would not be welcome in the established field. And so he, you know, thought, what can I do that nobody else is doing? And he found his advisor, I think, handed him the only book on sleep research that then existed, which, you know, recounted the experiments of the 10 or 12 researchers who'd done anything important in the field. And he said, wow, this is wide open. It's fascinating. And that's what he threw himself into.
It's interesting because he originally got his BS in chemistry. So he had no long-term interest in sleep, but it was by reason of that's what he needed to do at the time. What did people in his department, was it Anton Julius Carlson of the University of Chicago?
That's right.
He was the chair. Yeah. He was the chair of the physiology department. Did he think it was worthwhile for him to study sleep?
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is, among other things, I mean, it's a science story, certainly, but it's also an immigrant story.
Yeah.
Anton Julius Carlson was from Sweden, and he was another brilliant. He had started out as a brilliant kid, came over at the age of 16 and worked as a carpenter's apprentice and put himself through college in a PhD program, and wound up being pretty much the leading physiologist of his time in the United States. And Carlson was about 20 years older, I guess, than Kleitman. And I think that he saw in Kleitman somebody very similar to himself. And so he basically said to Kleitman, hey, look, you're a really smart guy. I think you're going places. Tell me what you want to do.
Huh.
And Kleitman said, well, I'd really like to be the world's first full-time sleep scientist. And Carlson said, go for it.
Now, there's previous research on different aspects of sleep, but I have to admit, Kleitman immediately recognized this. Most of these studies had too small a studied population, or they weren't done carefully enough. And that was one of his big things. He was very careful when he conducted studies.
Yes.
Now, people had studied, they wanted to know the depth of sleep. They wanted to know what part of the brain controlled sleep. What did people believe up until this time?
Well, so at that time, basically the idea was that every night your brain sort of shut down. And it shut down because it needed to rest. And so very little was happening in there. And Kleitman himself, to some extent, agreed with this. But he also thought something more might be going on. And as a good scientist, he really didn't make a lot of assumptions, or at least he tried not to. He couldn't help it because no one can help it. And I can get into that a bit later. But the idea was that sleep was a nightly shutdown. But he wanted to know, okay, well, you know, what triggers that? How does your body know it's time to shut down? And the thing that really, really fascinated him from the beginning was the rhythms of sleep and where they come from and to what extent they could be changed voluntarily without damaging people's health.
Now, Pavlov... and most people have heard of Pavlov. He ended up turning his attention to sleep, and I never knew that.
Yeah, so in the 1920s, right around the time that Kleitman was starting out, Ivan Pavlov, who of course was a Nobel Prize winner for his work in digestion, was also inventing this whole field of psychology involving conditioning. And what's now known as classical conditioning or Pavlovian conditioning, where you, put up a bowl of food in front of an animal and ring a buzzer or a bell, and the animal salivates at the prospect of the food. And you do that enough times, you can ring the buzzer without putting out the bowl of food, and the animal will still salivate.
Right.
That's called conditioning. And Pavlov, having discovered this amazing phenomenon, which really does happen, tried to apply it to everything. he loved it. And he thought, well, of course, sleep must be caused by this as well. And so he started publishing papers and giving lectures about how sleep, the real reason we sleep is because over the course of a day, we encounter so much stimulus, and we have so many conditioned responses that eventually our brains just shut down. We can't get overwhelmed. We can't take it anymore. And that was his theory. And Kleitman, this young upstart, one of the first really big things he did in his career, besides starting this lab, and where I should say his earliest experiments involved just keeping people up for as long as
possible. Oh, yeah.
He would stay up for 100 hours or so, and he would subject his experimental subjects, who were mostly other medical students, to the same thing and take careful readings of all of their vital signs, their heartbeat and their blood pressure and their blood oxygen and everything else, and just record it all. So Kleitman had already done a lot of work on what really, really happens when you sleep, which Pavlov had not done. And Kleitman, in I think it was 1928, went to this international congress of physiology and went up against Pavlov and said, "Hey, dude, you're wrong."
Whoa! I know that took a lot of chutzpah. It really did.
Yeah. Yes, it did.
And didn't win him any fans in Pavlov.
No. And he'd been a great, he had, as a young, as a student, as a PhD student, had been carrying on a correspondence with Pavlov. He had so much chutzpah that he just wrote to this Nobel Prize winner and said, "Hey, I understand you're studying sleep. Let me tell you what I'm doing." And the two were writing letters back and forth. Yeah. But he got up at this international conference and said, "Look, Ivan Pavlov, I respect you, but you got it backwards." And this certainly made an impression on his fellow scientists. But there was at the time, somebody, a local newspaper that was covering this conference, the guys, basically said, "This can, among the scientists, this is doubtless really, really important. But for us people, on the street, what we just wish is that the guy upstairs would stop playing saxophone and we could stop lying awake." And this is like literally an editorial. If we could stop lying awake in bed worrying about our, that our next paycheck isn't big enough, and that would help us much more. So, at that time, sleep science was not really seen as relevant to the average person. The leading sleep scientist, but the leading scientist studying sleep at the time was a guy named Laird, who did a lot of research, but unlike Kleitman, was not rigorous at all. And this was an important such an important feature of establishing this new branch of medical science, because, you know, this Laird would write in the popular newspapers, "Harry, I've done all this research, and here's what I found out. Women, the reason that women sleep better than men," which was a bizarre thing to say, yeah, was because they eat more candy.
Right.
right? Yeah, you know, and candy is a carbohydrate, and carbohydrates are conducive to sleep. You know, and he'd done maybe three experiments, which he hadn't followed through on very well and hadn't controlled very well. And he's publishing this stuff. And one of the honorable and wonderful things about Kleitman was he did not go for that. Did not go the easy route. He didn't go for fame, at least not at the beginning. He just was in there in the lab studying and studying and studying and trying not to draw conclusions unless he had something really, really, you know, some really good evidence for what he was going to say.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're talking about his new book, Mapping the Darkness, the visionary scientist who unlocked the mysteries of sleep. What's really fascinating, there are a lot of interesting things. I want to make sure we talk about this one. We got to talk about the Mammoth Cave experiment.
Oh, yeah.
That was wild. And that made a lot of press, too.
It did. And that was a big moment for sleep science, not just scientifically, but in its public platform. It was a real turning point. So 1930s, Kleitman's been studying now since 1925. He's been at it for quite a while, toiling in obscurity, essentially. He wanted to do, you know, he was very interested in the rhythms of sleep and where they came from. And one of the things he wanted to see was, well, what if instead of our natural sleep-wake rhythms are on a 24-hour cycle, which matches the Earth's 24-hour cycle. But what if we tried to go according to a different sleep-wake cycle? What if we did 40 hours or 48 or 36 or 12? And in all these cases, to figure out whether the body could adjust to these different schedules, he would measure people's body temperatures, because by then it had been established that our body temperature fluctuates by 1 or 2 degrees, reaching a low point in the wee hours of after midnight and reaching a high point somewhere in the late afternoon for most people. So he said, well, if I had people sleep and wake at these different hours, and I measure their body temperature, does the temperature come to match the sleep-wake cycle? And he found that, long story short, for most people, it was impossible to do that if you were too far from the 24-hour cycle. But if you were close enough to the 24-hour cycle, some people could adjust, but other people couldn't. And Kleitman was one of those people who couldn't adjust. And so he wondered, well, why is this? You know, is it something innate, or is it perhaps that some people are more sensitive to the external cues of the natural 24-hour day? So sunrise and sunset, the temperature getting cooler at night and warmer during the day, stuff like that. He thought, well, the only way to find out how much influence that has is by getting rid of that influence. So I need to go someplace where there's no, you know, where you don't have any sunrise or sunset. So the first thing he thought of was, I'm going to go to the Arctic Circle in the summertime when the sun never sets and see what happens, you know, see if I can change my sleep-wake cycle to a 28-hour day there. And the problem was, it was late 1930s and the middle of the Depression, and there was no money. So a colleague of his in the geology department at the University of Chicago said, hey, have you thought about a cave, and specifically Mammoth Cave, which was just beginning to be subsumed into the new national park system. And so it was accessible to the public, and it got thousands of tourists a year, even at that point. And you could go and find a chamber in the cave where you're cut off from the external cues of day and night and try to change your sleep-wake cycle and see what happens. So Kleitman decided to do exactly that. He made arrangements in 1938 with the Park Service to camp out in Mammoth Cave for a month with a young assistant. And over the course of that month, they, you know, they set up a couple of specially designed bunk beds with very extra long legs so that the rats wouldn't jump in, went down there and hooked up all sorts of measuring equipment throughout the night, and subjected themselves to a 28-hour sleep-wake cycle. And over the course of that experiment, the press got wind of it. Somehow, the various people who covered Mammoth Cave found out that this was happening, and they thought this is really amazing. And I guess it was the AP sent down a reporter who started writing dispatches from the cave, and this began making front page news all around the country. And also, when they left the cave at the end, there was a newsreel crew that came down and shot a newsreel of Kleitman and his young assistant, which was shown in movie theaters all across the country. And suddenly, this guy who had been toiling in obscurity for years and years and years was a national celebrity. And, what was interesting about this was the experiment itself was inconclusive. Once again, Kleitman could not adjust his body temperature to a 28-hour sleep-wake cycle. His young assistant could, and Kleitman thought, well, maybe this is because people are more adaptable when they're younger, or maybe I am just, have a different constitution. There's no way of knowing, and it was completely inconclusive. However, this experiment, for one, created a model for more carefully controlled experiments later that actually helped reveal the existence of a biological clock in human beings, which is an idea that Kleitman actually rejected. However, the important thing about this experiment was it made him famous.
Really did.
And suddenly, Americans and people who read the American press around the world started thinking, hey, sleep is actually really interesting. And Kleitman got this huge platform, and the next year he published the first real textbook of sleep science, this massive tome, which became the Bible of sleep science for decades afterwards.
It's called Sleep and Wakefulness, isn't it?
Yes, called Sleep and Wakefulness. Sleep and Wakefulness was a landmark book and made a huge impression. Other scientists suddenly realized, hey, this is a real thing. But it also gave him a real great platform as sort of the world's leading authority on sleep. And that led to him being able to do stuff that, he was then able to, when his lab found something interesting, he was able to get the attention of the world, essentially.
This story, and it's funny when you're reading your book, because a lot happens in this section. But then you realize they can't go any further until the EEG is really discovered. They really have to perfect something to read the electrical patterns in the human brain. And that's the next section of the book. And that's a huge, we can't even go into it now. That's a huge story. I mean, that's the whole discovery of the EEG and what's going on in the brain is an amazing story in and of itself.
Yes. And the EEG was actually invented in the 20s in Germany by a guy named Hans Berger, who was trying to investigate telepathy, psychic energy, and find a scientific way to do that. So it was started on this wild premise. But in the 50s, Kleitman had a student named Eugene Ossorinsky, who was a very surly young man. They got along very badly. But Ossorinsky needed to do his PhD thesis in physiology. And Kleitman says, well, why don't you study eye movements during sleep? And Ossorinsky hooked up an EEG machine, a very primitive one that had been in the department since the 30s. Nobody had used it. And started measuring, to begin with, the brainwaves of his 8-year-old son as he slept. Not only the brainwaves, but also his eye movements, because the EEG machine was a polygraph, meaning it could measure many different functions. And so he hooked it up to his son's eye sort of right near the eyeballs to pick up the electrical impulses when his eyes moved. And he discovered that periodically during the night and at quite regular intervals, his son's eyes were ricocheting back and forth as if he was watching a tennis match. And at that time, during those periods, his brain waves looked like they looked like he was awake. But when he went into the room and said, Armand, that was his kid's name, Armand didn't wake up. And so he realized he's really asleep, but his brain is doing something that looks like waking, and his eyes are jerking back and forth. What's going on? This turned out to be absolutely revolutionary, because up until that point, as I mentioned earlier, the scientific consensus was that during sleep, your brain shuts down. Kleitman thought that, too. He thought that the reason we dream is because our brain is really lethargic, and we have sort of vague feelings in our sensory information from what's happening in our body that goes to our brains, and our brains sleepily try to make sense of them. But it turned out that the brain was really, really active at certain times during the night.
We're going to have to stop there because we're out of time, Ken. And that's like that. And then the story just picks up from there. I just want to end with a quote that Kleitman used from, I think, a researcher named Pierre Ron. A theory is not the solution to a problem, but the statement of a problem to be resolved. Yeah. And that's that helped Kleitman really start the modern era of sleep research. There's so much more in this book. We've only started the story. I really strongly recommend it. My guest tonight has been award-winning journalist Kenneth Miller. And we're talking about his new book, Mapping the Darkness: The Visionary Scientists Who Unlocked the Mysteries of Sleep. Ken, it's been a real pleasure.
And likewise. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.